There we go.
Now we are.
We're live.
I'm going to call to order the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Today is Tuesday, March 16th. Members, the first item on the agenda is House File. We don't have the House File number. Well, it's an informational hearing on Emily's Law legislation, and there is an amendment. But, members, we're not going to be voting. I just wanted to give the author the opportunity to come and make his presentation and allow for folks to educate us on this issue. So, is the author of the bill here? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Bud Nornes, State Rep, and I have with me today Lynn Johnson. And before we begin the presentation, I have a few handouts. Would that be okay?
That would be fine.
I should point out the first one has something on both sides, so if you want to, we're saving on paper.
And members, because there is an amendment that Representative Nornes is going to be talking about, we did not include the original bill in your packet. So, members, just so you know, the amendment is in your packet. Go ahead, Representative Nornes.
Okay. Just mention the handouts, first of all. The first one you're receiving is a copy from, or maybe Lynn can clarify it. I believe it's from our county prosecutor?
Yes, and the probation officer.
And that letter is in support of the original bill that we're not dealing with today, but it's the same issue primarily. But that's just for your information. The second handout is a copy of an editorial that was in today's Fergus Falls paper, where they are in support of, again, what the Johnsons are hoping to do through the legislative process. First, want to thank the chair for allowing us to be here today, for the committee members for giving us this time. As was stated, we do have an amendment that changes what our plan is as far as legislative success is concerned. Before we get into the details of the amendment, I'd like to have Lynn Johnson kind of give us a little background for the members that perhaps are not aware of Emily's story. Would that be all right?
That would be fine. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Lynn Johnson. I would like to begin by thanking Representative Hillstrom and the rest of the committee for holding this informational hearing on Emily's Law, and also for allowing me to come and testify today. My husband Travis couldn't be here with us. He is actually at home with our daughter Abby, since we don't currently use daycare. On June 16th, 2006, our lives changed forever. That morning, I dropped our two-year-old daughter, Emily Lynn Johnson, at her daycare provider's house. Little did I know that would be the last time I would see my daughter smile or tell her I loved her. Less than 8 hours later, I received a call from the provider that when she went to wake Emily up from her nap, she wouldn't wake up and she had called 911. I was in Fargo, and while I rushed home, my mind raced. Did she have an allergic reaction to something, and why wouldn't she wake up? Did she fall and hit her head? Once I got to the ER, I realized the situation was much more serious than I could ever imagine. The next day at 8:59 p.m., we held our daughter as they removed the life support, and she took her last breath. In the days that followed, we learned that our daycare provider's 13-year-old son, who was just 19 days away from his 14th birthday, had gone into our daughter's room where she was napping and sexually assaulted her and violently threw her against a wall. During the weeks that followed, more questions went through our head. Why? Why could a person not be punished for this violent crime? Why was it that our state doesn't allow our prosecutors to make a decision based on the seriousness of the crime to try the criminal as an adult? And the final thought, something must be changed so no other family has to feel the injustice we have felt from our justice system. The prosecutor on our case has stated that if she had had the option, she would have strongly considered trying this person as an adult. And as Representative Nornes has stated, those are the letter from her and the probation officer involved with our case supporting this legislation. Our criminal case did not go to trial. The young man pled guilty to second-degree manslaughter. When we began this journey 3 years ago, I could never imagine the opposition we have hit. Very early on, it became apparent to us that this was a party line issue and that wasn't what we expected. We expected it to be about the issue, not what one party did to the other party or vice versa in past situations. Each year we have taken what the opposition has said and we have revamped the bill accordingly, but continue to receive the same negative opposition. Our goal is to find a solution that pleases both sides, and we think this amendment achieves that. What can be wrong with giving our prosecutors the choice to try a case as they feel would be the most appropriate with the circumstances given? Our responsibility as adults is to protect our fellow human beings. Let's not lose sight of that responsibility. Let us not find ourselves protecting juvenile criminals with more passion than we protect each other. That is why we are here. We believe that Emily's Law will help Minnesotans keep Minnesotans safe and feel that it will deter crime and, most importantly, keep others from having to go through the injustice we have. The young man that killed our precious Emily is attending public school in the Twin Cities and is back with his family. That is less than 3 years from the time he committed this heinous crime, just barely longer than our little girl was alive. Let me leave you with this. We live in the greatest country in the world, a democracy run by the people, for the people. It's a system of checks and balances. People have been put in place to do a certain job. You are not a court. You are not a judge. Let those who have the facts and the evidence to make an informed decision decide. Please give prosecutors this option. Please pass House File 0317, or also known as Emily's Law. There is support out there for this law. We have hundreds of emails in favor of this bill, and I'm sure some of you have received those in the last week or in the last years. At this time, I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Nornes.
I need to explain now what the amendment will do. Again, in the past, we have basically been trying to just change the law where we've had a 14 as the minimum age. We were just trying to make it 13. We thought that was a small change, but we've run into more opposition, I guess, than we expected over the last 3 years. So we also understand there's a time when you have to change the plan. And so this year, what the amendment does is looks at the extended jurisdictional juvenile prosecution portion of the law. Now, that does change. That's certainly 14. This changes as 14 changes to 13. And as I understand it, in the similar situation that we're dealing with here with Emily, that individual would be tried as a juvenile and prosecuted and convicted potentially. But in the event of upon probation and a violation of probation, that's where a more severe penalty would kick in. And that's where, I guess, Emily's Law would then be would be the change. So it really doesn't change the procedure unless, again, there's a violation of probation under the existing law. So we think it's a big compromise for the family. But if this, this may be all the legislature will permit at this time. And I understand we can't take a vote today on it, but we did want you members of this committee to understand what we're trying to accomplish in the event we see it at a later date, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, Representative Nornes. Questions from Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nornes, I'm trying to recall the discussion that we've had on this in previous years, and I can't remember some of the facts. Well, first question, Representative Nornes, is I see from this probation county letter on official letterhead that Otter Tail County has taken an official position on this. Are there any other county boards besides Otter Tail that have taken official positions in supporting this?
Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, we have not sought that either. So it happened in Otter Tail County. We basically just focused on that.
Okay.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Nornes, I also don't recall from last year the discussion on what other jurisdictions states or even countries have this kind of breakdown of age, if it's 14, or if some of them go to 13 or 12, and maybe you can help me remember that.
Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesch. Now, you're referencing the original intent of our original bill.
Representative Lesch.
Well, I believe, I didn't bring my list with me, but there are a number of states that have 12, some have none, no minimum age. There's probably 12, 13 that are the same as Minnesota with age 14. So it's all over. And some, in the event of murder, have a different age. We may have an answer for you here from Mrs. Johnson.
Representative Hillstrom and Representative Lynch, I don't have it as far as the EJJ, but we, in past, we've had the stats. What we have is there are 13 states with the minimum age of 13. In Kansas and Vermont, the age is 10. It's 14 in Indiana, but 10 for murder. Missouri and Colorado, it's 12. It's 12 in Montana for murder. In Illinois, Mississippi, New Hampshire, North Carolina, and Wyoming, it's 13. And in New York, it's 14, except for murder.
Okay.
Representative Lesch, then Representative Olin.
And then just last, by way of comment, I think the I was just talking with Representative Coles about this earlier. I think the reason we have it at 14 is we all learn in law school that there are three levels of demarcation for culpability, 0 to 7, 7 to 14, 14 to 21. We, of course, changed the 21 designation from English common law so more people could serve in the military. You make it at 18, age of the majority. But I guess what I'd like to just be sure about, that if we are going to change this demarcation from 14 in this instance, that why 13 would be the best? Why couldn't we go to 10? Why couldn't we go to 9?
Representative Norris, Ms. Johnson.
If it's okay if I answer that, Representative Hillstrom, my husband and I, we'd rather have there be no age. This is part of the compromise. We'd personally rather have it look at the actual evidence of the crime versus the age and the individual for each crime, but we got the pressure that we needed to put an age on it. If it was up to us, we'd have no age. It'd be up to the individual circumstances.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Nornes.
I was just going to add one. Representative Lesch, the reason you don't recall some of those details, it's been 2 years since we've been here. So I'm just giving you the benefit of the doubt there.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. But one quick comment, and that's not to, I think we should listen to some of these witnesses who are actually in the legal world or whatever before we start asking Representative Nornes, who's doing a fairly good job explaining him, but he's not in the legal world of knowing exactly what EJJ, et cetera, is, and there are people in this room who probably can explain some stuff a little better than Representative Nornes. No offense to the author of the bill.
No events taken.
Further questions of Representative Nornes or the witness? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? I guess John Stewart has signed up ahead of time. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. Prior to having this job, I worked as a lawyer in juvenile court for 10 years, and I served on the committee that recommended the EJJ law that we have now to the legislature in 1994. That was a product of defense lawyers, prosecutors, judges, probation, corrections, social workers, legislators. We had a task force of about 20 people that met for 2 years in developing the EJJ law that we have now. And I came today because I wanted to present just some of the issues that would arise if you were going to make a law change like this. First of all, for the benefit of people who aren't in juvenile court a whole lot, if somebody is prosecuted as an extended jurisdiction juvenile, they have all the procedural rights of an adult because they have the possibility of ending up in the adult prison. And so they have what you'd call the due process rights that an adult would have, including a trial by jury. Secondly, if they're convicted, and this is the essential thing that makes the EJJ different from either certification or just regular handling as a delinquent. If they're convicted, they get two sentences. They get a juvenile court disposition, and they also have an adult prison sentence from the sentencing guidelines hanging over their head. So the gist of it is that the juvenile is supposed to complete the juvenile court disposition, or else they can be revoked and be sent to the adult prison. And from that, I have to say, this state is the first state in the country to have a law like this. It's called blended sentencing. And within 5 years, 12 other states had picked this up and adopted it. It became a sort of an intermediate tool for juvenile court if they had a serious situation that didn't quite get to the point where they wanted to transfer somebody to adult court. But the way EJJ works raises three concerns that I have about extending it to 13-year-olds in situations like this. I just want to outline those for you. First of all, the younger the child is, the less effective the approach is of telling them that they have to comply with orders or else something bad might happen to them off in the future. You know, anybody that has raised a teenager knows that the ability to use good judgment and plan for things that might happen in the future, whether it's, you know, why do you need to go to the dentist, or, you know, because years from now you might lose your teeth, stuff like that. Teenagers have trouble with that because of adolescent brain development, the portion of the brain that looks ahead and foresees consequences down the road, that's the last thing to develop. And the younger the child, the less effective it is to have something hanging over their head. Now, at my age, if somebody told me that I had to follow certain rules or else I was going to go to prison, I would follow those rules really, really well, because that part of my brain is developed. But that's not the case with juveniles, and the younger they are, the less developed it is. This leads to a second issue, which is the younger the child, the less likely they are to be competent to be prosecuted. The leading researcher on this is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis named Grisso. And Grisso got a grant to do an 8-year study comparing whether juveniles were competent to be prosecuted with adults who had the question of whether they were competent to be prosecuted. And his conclusion, after looking at the data for 8 years, was that under age 15, there is a sharp drop-off in understanding the process and making the decisions that you have to make if you're a defendant in a criminal case. And keep in mind, the EJJ defendant has all the rights of an adult, including the jury trial. So there's a sharp drop-off in what we call competency. And if you had in Minnesota 13-year-olds going through that process, there would be a lot of them that would be found not competent to be prosecuted, and they would end up perhaps becoming a CHIPS case or cycling back to some kind of voluntary placement. The third problem is that let's suppose that you have the 13-year-old successfully prosecuted as an extended jurisdiction juvenile, and for whatever reason, their dysfunctional features of their personality or the resources that are available in that county, or for whatever reason, they don't complete the juvenile disposition. Well, now they've got the adult prison sentence hanging over their head. I focus on this because this is really my main concern about this, is the possibility of having 13-year-olds going to the adult prison in Minnesota. It's not the question of whether they should be held accountable for what they did. Certainly, any case anywhere resembling the terrible circumstances that you're hearing about here, any case like that demands accountability. But last time a version of this bill came through, I checked with the Department of Corrections, and I found out they had just under 10,000 people in the adult prison system. And this is in a system where you can go if you're 14. But they only had four who were under 16. Those four were all 15. They had about 10 more who were 16. And everybody else, something like 9,500 everybody else's, they were all age 17 and up. So from the point of view of programming and management in the institutions, you are possibly creating a very difficult management situation if you're putting somebody who's essentially an eighth grader in an adult prison. I was speaking at one of the state prisons last week, and I asked the guys in the audience, what would you think about having a 13-year-old be admitted here to your prison? And all of the prisoners said, no, this would not work out very well. But let's forget about our humanitarian concerns about what happens to this 13-year-old for a minute, and think about this from the point of view of public safety. These sentences in Minnesota are governed by the sentencing guidelines, and so you can look at the numbers on the chart and you can predict pretty well when the individual would get out of prison. So let's say you started with these various offenses and you ended up going to prison at 13, and there you are in the prison. A couple of them, the person would be due for release when they're still a teenager. A couple of them more, the person would be due for release when they're in their 20s. The third group, second-degree intentional murder, the person would be due for release at age 30. So you have to ask yourself, whatever it was that made this individual a dangerous individual that committed a homicidal act, what is the best strategy for public safety for dealing with this person? Are we better off to keep him in prison, say, 6 or 7 years and then let him out again when he's 20 years old? Or are we better off using specialized juvenile programs like Red Wing or Woodland Hills or something else that is attuned to the developmental problems of dysfunctional teenagers?
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. And I was going to stay out of this discussion, but when we start referring to the situation we just did, of what if we put this person in prison and sentencing guidelines will let him out. Mr. Stewart, correct me if I'm wrong. If he were in the prison situation, isn't it true that they're going to evaluate him in the particular facts you just heard as to what level of sex offender he reaches?
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, in the version of the amendment that I saw, sex offenses aren't covered. It's all degrees of homicide. So this person that we're talking about hypothetically today, but we know it's also a real person, we're talking about homicide cases. Now, in the area of 13-year-old sex offenders that get sent to the adult prison, I have no idea, but I believe they'd be sentenced on the guidelines.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. In the facts that you were just presented, wasn't it true that the sex that it was a criminal sexual event that caused the death, which would put it distinctly not only in the homicide world, but in sex offender status too, if you're doing your job as a state prison prosecutor or whoever else.
Mr. Stewart.
Madam Chair, Representative Olin, well, the actual prosecutor in the case prosecuted this young man for second-degree culpable manslaughter, and the sentence for that is 48 months. So the young man, if he went to prison at 13, would be released at 16.
Okay. One more question, Representative Olin, and then we have a couple of other testifiers.
Thank you, Madam
Representative.
I'm not going to belittle the point, but when you're talking about prosecuting for, because of the situation at his age and what was available to him in the statutes, it was, which is not what we're discussing right now, was obviously probably part of the factors that entered in. I just want the record to at least be fair above board and not just slid entirely one direction or the other. And I'm not even saying which way I'll vote in the final conclusion of this bill.
We're not voting, Representative Olin.
Well,
this is an informational hearing.
If we ever do.
All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really, that was just what I wanted to conclude with, that sure, I'm a public defender, and Representative Olin and all of you know I'm a public defender, so I'm thinking of this person as a potential client. But I've also served on a lot of committees and task forces where people have talked about public safety. And that those discussions have sunk into me to a degree. And you have to look at what the life development of this person is going to be, I believe, and you have to say, what's going to make Minnesota safer in regard to this person who's 13 now, but in 10 years they'll be 23, in 20 years they'll be 33, what are we going to do with this person then? So that to me is one of the problems of putting a 13-year-old in adult prison.
Okay. I guess there's one more question from Representative Coles for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I know we want to move on, and I just say that I think it's unfortunate that we're only doing an informational hearing, but I appreciate you at least providing that courtesy to Representative Nornes. Mr. Stewart, I guess what I'm confused by is the objection that I'm hearing, that we've got to, I guess I don't see anything magical about the age 13 versus 14, and you're making some very compelling arguments as to why a prosecutor may choose not to have a 13-year-old enter into or prosecute somebody under EJJ. The same arguments could be made about a 14-year-old. Why don't we allow the courts and the prosecutor and the defense attorney the opportunity to make those arguments in an individual case? And if it's not going to be a good idea for public safety, isn't a prosecutor doing his or her duty not going to prosecute the juvenile under EJJ? I'm trying to. My job isn't to decide each and every individual case. I gotta consider statewide policy, and I don't see the magic between 13 and 14.
Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Coles. Well, this whole process is a good illustration of the difficulty of drawing lines in this area. You know, I don't see why a 12-year-old might not be doing something bad, and we'd be back here talking about somebody who's 12, and then some 11-year-old might do something bad, and so forth. And I think that I know Mr. Johnson, the Washington County Attorney, is coming up, and maybe he can talk to you about the way a prosecutor would look at this. I know that there are a lot of forces in the environment where a prosecutor works that lead them to make decisions. And I think in the past, the legislature has created some structure so that those decisions would be made in a structured manner. And I think when you put together the EJJ law after 2 years of study back in the 90s, I thought that laid out pretty good boundaries for how people were going to operate.
Thank you.
Can say, well, maybe we shouldn't have those boundaries, but frankly, I think they've served the citizens of Minnesota pretty well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nornes.
I was just going to point out that you had set aside a certain amount of time for us today, and and it's in your hands, but...
Yes, and I will give you some opportunity.
I want to be fair to the Johnson family that we're not overwhelmed today.
Absolutely, and Representative Nornes, I will give you an opportunity to respond as well. Okay?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. I believe... Can I just see who else? Yes, come to the table. Can I see just who else wanted to speak either for or against? So there's two more. Representative Nornes, there's just two more.
Yeah, okay. I was only suggesting that you limit
okay.
testimony.
Great, thanks. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go.
My name is Doug Johnson. I'm the Washington County Attorney, and I'd just like to point out that once again, the public defenders expect the prosecutors to answer the heavy questions.
Mr. Johnson, is today your birthday?
Oh, cripes. Who told you that? Yes.
Okay. Go ahead. Represent.
All right. And I'm probably older than anybody else in the room. Having been born before the end of the Second World War. But I am also the Washington County Attorney. I'm also the former Wadena County Attorney. So I'm familiar with both the rural and the urban areas. I spent most of my career in juvenile court, and I'm co-chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and I am speaking on behalf of the association. I believe in the juvenile system in Minnesota. We change kids. We fix kids. We change their behavior. We stop future criminal behavior, and at the same time, we protect public safety. And this cannot be said of the criminal system. And the current proposal is to allow extended juvenile jurisdiction for 13 years, 13-year-olds. You've had that explained to you. In 2008, there was a proposal to certify 13-year-olds to the adult court. Minnesota County Attorneys Association opposed that proposal. We had a position paper that said there was no need to change the age, but we did tell you that if there was a need, you felt there was a need to change the age, that a possible solution was to EJJ 13-year-olds for first and second degree murder and attempts. That's perhaps where this proposal came from. However, I want to make it very clear. We continue to believe that there is no need for change, and we oppose this proposal, even though this idea may have come from our position paper. The county attorney's position is that this proposal is not good public policy. Many years ago, the decision, and I don't know who made that decision, but this body did, to make the dividing line between children and adults at age 14. This has served Minnesota well. You cannot give us a long history where we've had 12 and 13-year-olds who have been doing horrendous cases. There is no outcry that 13-year-olds in this state are out of control and are continually committing numerous heinous crimes. This proposal is a response to one heinous crime, and my heart goes out as a parent and a grandparent to the Johnson family. But I want you to understand that this proposal will not prevent any future crime. And it would not have prevented this crime. No 13-year-old is going to keep from committing a crime because they think at some point down the future they might go to prison for it. I've always said, I've always dealt with only two types of criminals. Those are those who don't think they're going to get caught, and that includes me and you as we're driving a car over the speed limit. And those who don't care if they're caught. And most 13-year-olds don't think they're going to get caught. So we're not going to prevent any crimes. We're not doing anything for public safety. And that's why we're against it. What's the point? The real need is overwhelming mental health issues that the state is dealing with troubled youth. It's great in Washington County, and from Wadena County, I can tell you the need is even greater. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association strongly supports options for increased services in diagnosis, treatment, and general mental health services for kids. You provide that, and you will make a big difference for Minnesota youth. And I want to make one thing clear in conclusion. Prosecutors are not asking for this bill. We are opposing it. And we are opposing it because we believe it is bad public policy. Thank you.
Thank you. questions? Seeing none, next. The final testifier. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and then go ahead. And then, Representative Nornes, you'll be allowed to respond.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kelvin Sari. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association. We asked the committee administrators to pass out our organization agenda to you, which is a rather thicker pamphlet, which I believe you have today, and I think we've done that in previous testimony before your committee. And our testimony is based on this specific issue on pages 10, 11, and 12 of that particular document. In the interest of time to expedite matters, I don't mean to duplicate what's been already told to you by Mr. Stewart and Mr. Johnson. The corrections is the third arm of that facet that, of the court system that comes in and look at this. The Minnesota Corrections Association has taken a strong position and did extensive research on this starting 3 years ago when this concept of 13-year-old certification first was being considered. We have updated that that document, and when we heard that the concept of maybe considering the changing the age with the EJJ, we asked our experts, our research people, to do further research and take a candid look at good correctional practice in reference to the certification, lowering the certification age for the EJJ status. Our comments from the research that's been done is included in that policy statement on page 10 and 11, and I'm not going to go through and itemize that all for you. We've got a lot of statistical data in there. There's some data from other states in response to what Mrs. Johnson has indicated you previously in her testimony that we don't disagree with. As I talk to national organizations, specifically I spoke last Friday with the American Probation and Parole Association, of which our organization is an affiliate member, and they look at from a national standard what is taking place around the country. And of course we all know that Minnesota can be proud of the fact that it's in the forefront with good correctional practice. And we find that around the country, as indicated previously, they're all over the page on EJJ certification. There are, however, it was pointed out by the APPA people, that there are many, many states that are beginning to really question the good correctional practice concept of lowering the age to age 13 for certification or even considering EJJ. It just doesn't seem to be an effective place. I think the data that we have in our material here is kind of self-explanatory, as alludes to the same thing that Mr. Stewart talked about with the emotional and physical status of juveniles that come through the system at a young age, in addition to what happens in a prison setting, and we've got the data there to back that up. Many states are reconsidering the minimum age of entry into the adult system at the present time because we found that, by and large, it just hasn't been effective. Mr. Stewart indicated to you that there's only 14 people in the state of Minnesota that have gone through EJJ. As I talk through correctional administrators and the treatment people, they're all severely challenged to come up with adequate programs for those young offenders who are in need of treatment. There's no question about that, but we're challenged in every perspective to find an adequate program for them. Budget cuts dating back to 2003 have further hindered and almost made impossible to provide effective programming for EJJ offenders, and frankly, from the research that we've done in regard to the proposal for EJJ status, is that this is not good correctional policy, and we would agree with the positions taken by the County Attorneys Association and the public defenders that nothing is gained by it. I would suggest to you, we have included on page 12, I think, 9 or 10 resources that you could look at, and there's some good websites there to give you further data, more detailed data from what we've provided here, but I'd ask that you have your staff research some of this for you to allow you to get the best information you can to make the best decision. We feel that our goal as an organization in corrections, representing correctional professionals from managers and supervisors to the probation officers in the field to the vendors and the treatment program that we have, Our goal is to provide you with the best information we can, and frankly, we do not feel that this is good correctional practice. Thank you for giving us the time.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to one of the experts in the field. If a juvenile is prosecuted under EJJ and convicted, is it mandatory that he be remanded to the adult correction system, or could he go into the juvenile correction system?
Madam Chair, sorry. Representative Shemansky, they would be in the adult system should they violate, and that's just part of the statute with it. And that was the provision of the EJJ statute, is that they remain within the juvenile system with the understanding that they have an adult sentence. And the problem comes in is if there's a violation. And we all know if you're dealing with a disturbed child at such a young age to deal that is involved in heinous crimes of a violent nature, there's in all probability there's going to be some violations. National statistics show us that about 78% of juvenile offenders ages 13 and 14 that commit violent crimes are likely to reoffend.
Further questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was alluded to or mentioned, I think, by Mr. Stewart, that where our present age limits are were put in statute were based on British law from some years ago. And I think that as we come along in society, technology has taken over to the point that we no longer use paper anymore, but we use the technology. And I think and it was mentioned earlier that some states don't even have an age limit regarding juveniles going into the system. So I'm just wondering if we get caught up in doing the same thing as Grandma and Grandpa used to do from years gone by, and we forget about what has come forward and how the society has changed, and we've loosened our laws to a point that we've loosened our standards, or we've lowered our standards in today's society to the point that there are no standards for kids anymore. And I'm just wondering if we shouldn't be thinking a little bit about today and tomorrow rather than in the past.
Is that a question, Representative Anderson?
Well, I'd just like to have a comment. I'd like to have a response to that.
You'd like a response?
I would.
Okay. Would anyone like to respond to that?
I'll just make this comment, Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Anderson. I don't disagree with you at all. In fact, our staff people, as we hold these discussions at various committee levels, certainly agree with you. There's no magic number around about the age 14, 15, or 13, whatever it might be. It's simply we have to look at what is the best correctional practice that's out there, and we don't see that lowering the age does anything effective by lowering the age.
Thank you, Mr. Sari. Representative Nornes, I'll give you the final opportunity. Representative Lash.
Sure. I hope this isn't too long of a question, but I would like to ask Mr. Stewart or Mr. Johnson, or Mr. Sari for that matter. We've heard a lot of talk about the best interests of, you know, best practices and how we rehabilitate people. I am interested in hearing about. Obviously, it's a priority of mine as a prosecutor myself. But I'm wondering, if someone kills my child, I'm going to be kind of angry if they're walking around 3 years later. Is retribution or punishment an appropriate consideration in this instance? Or are we simply talking about making sure there are no reoffenses and that everyone gets treated well in prison and whatnot?
Mr. Johnson.
I was just going to add a comment, Madam
Chair. Representative Nornes.
I need to point out that what we're talking about today in no way affects what happened in the Johnson family. We're not trying to reopen, change, or the outcome is settled and it's done. This is looking forward to any possible similar incident and hopefully trying to eliminate the problems and pain that the Johnson family have gone through.
Thank you, Representative Norris. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't want to sound facetious, but, you know, Einstein said time is relative. Now, if you remember back when you were in elementary school, how long the school day lasted and how long the school year lasted. 4 years, 5 years, 6 years for a 13-year-old is a lot longer than 14 years or 4 years for me. It's all relative. And we deal with that. Now, that might not be a good answer. You want to know retribution and punishment? Yeah, we should have some. But let's keep it proportional. I would have handled the case a little different than they did in Otter Tail County. We would have prosecuted them, and maybe we would have done a manslaughter, but we would have done the crim sex thing also. A few years ago, we had a 14-year-old that we charged with a sex crime. We convicted him in juvenile court. We put him in treatment. We put him in treatment for 5 years, and it didn't work. And as he approached his 19th birthday, we committed him for his sex crimes, and he's in treatment right now. There are other ways to deal with these cases than just simply saying, let's lower the age to 13.
We have two more questions, Representative Bigham, Representative Kelly, and I want to give Representative Nornes an opportunity to close. Representative Bigham.
Thank you. And first, happy birthday, County Attorney Johnson. And second, thank you for your service. You're a frequent face up here testifying on legislation. I know you're coming in your home stretch of your last days here in as county attorney, and just appreciate your service.
Thank you.
My question is you've been involved a lot in juvenile justice matters. And since I actually tend to agree that I don't know if there is a magical age to, you know, I haven't really heard anything today that convinces me that 13, 14, 10 is the right age. Why not have the discretion for you as a county attorney? Why not, you know, I know in the death penalty cases, and we don't have that here, and I'm not advocating for that, but there's usually a committee that gets together and decides whether or not the prosecuting office is going to pursue that, and they go over the merits of the case, and then they kind of make a decision about whether or not it's they have the discretion to pursue it in some states. So I'm wondering, why not give you that discretion?
Mr. Johnson.
Because for me, it's just opening up the floodgates. We start with a 13-year-old EJJ. And then let's go to, well, why don't we certify him then? Well, if we're going to certify him, how about a 12-year-old? Well, we'll compromise and we'll do EJJ. Well, then let's certify a 12-year-old. And then how about an 11? And where do you draw the line? It's a public policy issue. And it's on your shoulders. Where are you going to draw the line? And I don't see any compelling evidence that we should change that line. We've got one case. It's a horrendous case. And based on that, you're being asked to change the age of EJJ. Is there a need for this? That's my concern. Is there a need for this? It's your responsibility to deal, and I don't want to lecture you, but it's your responsibility to deal with good public policy. Not to respond to one case. We've seen enough of that. I mean, when I started practicing law, we could get the criminal code into one volume, and there were a whole bunch of other chapters in it. You just keep expanding it. And a lot of it's just based on various problems that the community has that you try to fix after it's been happening. And now is the time to draw the line and say, we're not going to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Nornes. Representative Kelly, sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Johnson, I guess I'd have to respectfully disagree. I'm not an attorney, and I don't practice law, and I believe that every case is probably going to be rather different and independent. But you'd made the statement that you believe the system's working well. The system works pretty well right now. Was there an outcry when we reduced the age to 14? Was there an outcry that says all these 14-year-olds were doing these heinous things?
I have not ever studied the history of when it was changed to 14. I don't know if it ever was changed or if it just came in when they did the, I think it was in 1963 when they redid the criminal code. And that was when I graduated from high school and wasn't paying much attention.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Johnson, so basically my point is that I believe it was rather arbitrary to begin with. So what I hear is the discussion that I believe it is the court's responsibility to look at the situation and to determine
in these cases how we should try these individuals, because every individual is different. I don't think you leave it up to public policy as a cookie cutter approach in crimes that are so different and tragic. But I guess I would leave with that. I believe it was arbitrary to begin with, so I don't see where we enter an age is relevant at all. But thank you, Madam Chair.
May I respond?
Mr. Johnson.
I would agree. It probably was arbitrary, but it's also worked.
Thank you. Representative Nornes.
Madam Chair, I would like to have Tori Westrom kind of sum up, if you mind.
That would be fine.
Yeah, I would only conclude by saying that the system has not worked well in the case of the Johnson family. They claim it has. I'd say it hasn't. So.
Thank you. Representative Westrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Madam Chair, I just want to clarify. I think Mrs. Johnson would have a couple comments if she could rebut, and if Mike's testimony would stop her from doing that, I would rather her be able to talk than me. I just want to
go ahead, Representative Westrom, and then Ms. Johnson can come back.
Madam Chair, and I'll be brief, but committee members, I think several of you hit on some key points at the end. Representative Lesch, a punishment, that's what I've been sitting back there thinking. All these paid lobbyists that you've been hearing from, not a one of them talks about punishment. Now, we've got a family in Fergus Falls without a daughter, and 3 years later, the guy that killed their child is absent punishment. I can't believe the testimony you've just been hearing from people worried more about the guy that killed the two-year-old Emily than the fact that he should someday have a little punishment. We're trying to bring forth a glaring omission in the system that these paid lobbyists are standing up here trying to protect whatever interests the criminals. I just ask you to consider that. And many of you have brought those points out, and I'm just heartened that your committee members, Madam Chair, have saw through this. But this is what we're talking about. There's no magic to 14 years, 14 years, 2 months, 13 years, 10 months. This guy was 3 weeks from turning 14. So could we go back just 3 weeks and at least this guy would have been covered? There's no magic to it. Let's let the prosecution and the courts have more option and flexibility when somebody commits a heinous crime like throwing a child against the wall and letting her die. Unbelievable. And so I just want to bring out that point, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Westrom. We would want to have allow Ms. Johnson to make the final comment, if that's
thank
what you'd
you
like.
The hearing.
Thank you.
And I hope we can garner support with amendments or what comes forward next, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this short. I mean, we've heard the same thing the last 3 years, so I really wish my husband was here, so he's much more better speaking off the top of his head. But, you know, the question has come up in years past about how many 14-year-olds are in prison for murder and stuff, and luckily the answer is zero. So realistically, we need to just think why that is, and that is because they know the difference between right and wrong. And the effect of lowering the age, and I wish we didn't have to do the AJJ. I wish that our initial bill we brought 3 years ago is the one we were still talking about today. But we've tried to make the adjustments according to where the comments have come. But the effect of lowering the age will be minute but necessary in cases in future situations. Nobody knows the details of our case. I wish I could share them all with you. But I don't want you to have the nightmares and the visions that my husband and I have to have because we know what he did. And I just, again, there's the only thing I want to stress is what harm is lowering this? If a prosecutor doesn't want to do this, then just ignore it. But there's prosecutors out there that would want this. And I don't care if it's one or all of them. One would have wanted this. And the last thing I just want to say in our case, because it's been brought up all 3 years, is yes, in our case, he pled guilty to second-degree manslaughter, and they keep telling you that he'd only serve 48 months. He pled guilty to second-degree manslaughter because that was the highest, as a juvenile, he could be charged. In our case, if he would have been an adult, he would have been charged with a higher, stronger crime. thank you for your time.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
It.
Thank you.
And I just want to thank you again, Representative Gilstrom, for the opportunity to present our case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. Members, I do believe that Representative Nornes will be offering this as an amendment on the House floor, as he has done every year as long as he has been here. So I wanted to make certain that we did have the public policy discussion. So thank you, Representative Nornes and Representative Westrum. With that, the next bill on the agenda is House File 3634. While you move to the committee table, I would take a motion to approve the minutes. Representative Bigham moves the minutes from March 11th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Jackson moves that House File 3634, first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's my understanding you have an A1 amendment, Representative Jackson. Is that correct?
I do.
Representative Jackson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Jackson.
Thank you. This bill is in response to some understandable concern after the Star Tribune published a story, I believe, out of Representative Katz's district concerning a chiropractor who had committed felony-level criminal sexual conduct with patients, and his license suspension lasted a couple years while he was in prison, as a matter of fact, and he came right back out to practice his chiropractic trade. This bill would prohibit Health Related Licensing Board from granting a license to any person who's been convicted of a felony level criminal sexual conduct offense. And it was suggested by Representative Abler that it be extended beyond chiropractors to the healthcare providers that are listed in Section 214.01, Subdivision 2. And I can go down that list if folks are interested. Board of Nursing, Chiropractic, Optometry, Physical Therapy, Psychology, Social Work, Family and Behavior Therapy, Nutrition and Dietetic Practice, Dentistry, Pharmacy, Podiatry, and Veterinary Medicine. I would stand for question, and what do you have? Any questions?
Well, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Court Holton, and I represent the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. Ever notice when witnesses come before you and they say that they're going to be brief, that they never are? But this one will be. When this incident took place, I looked up this law for the first time. I didn't even know that the situation was as it is. I just assumed that this type of disqualifier would already be in place. I represent another group of people that work at horse tracks, and even the people that we've got back in the back cleaning up after the horses have to have a license, and they lose it for any felony conviction. So I think my group and these other groups doing what the Minnesota Medical Association has already done is very proper. I would call it a no-brainer. If we get into detailed questions, I'll be happy to respond. And that's all my testimony.
Questions from members. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I was just interested to know what this person did and why he was allowed, he or she allowed to, if get their license back.
Representative Jackson.
Well, committed a felony level criminal sexual conduct, and the details I don't have.
And Representative Cornish, the reason they were allowed, or the reason they were permitted to get their license back, is the law does not permit this group to be excluded from getting their license back currently under the law, and that's the reason for Representative Jackson's bill.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Cornish.
They couldn't do it?
The board could not keep this person from getting his license back because state statute does not permit it except for the Board of Medicine, I think.
Correct.
Was the only one in statute that was allowed.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, did we adopt this amendment
We did Representative
okay.
Coles.
Madam Chair, Representative Jackson, I don't have any problem with what you're trying to do. I support it completely. The question I have is, as I'm looking at the list that I have of all the boards that are impacted here, does the unlicensed complementary and alternative health care practice have a credential? I mean, how do we, that's what the amendment says, you know, you lose your credential or you can't get your credential back. I think we have some kind of credential for dietitians and those in the nutrition field, but I don't know. Do each of these have a credential?
Mr. Holton?
Madam Chairman, Representative, I don't know if you have this list or maybe that's what you're reading for. Every one of those listed is under Chapter 214, Sub 2, and they're all licensed by that health-related licensing board. Therefore, they each have a credential. If you're there, you have your credential from your license. So, yes, is the answer to your question.
And Representative Coles, this amendment came from Representative Abler. He thought it was more comprehensive.
That doesn't necessarily make it more palatable to me, Madam Chair.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Coles. Further questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Jackson renews her motion that House File 3634, First Engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Jackson.
Thank you, committee, and thanks to Representative Kath for his help on this.
Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal, we've been informed that the Transportation Committee wants this next. Okay. So Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 3650 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. Representative Rosenthal, do you have an amendment?
I do, Madam Chair. It's the A-10 amendment.
Representative Rosenthal moves the A-10 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 3650 allows units of government and peace officers the authority to impound vehicles under certain circumstances. And I have with me Lance Platt, who will talk to the specifics.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Lance Platt, Executive Director of the Minnesota Service Station Association and the Professional Towing Association. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Our associations represent over 500 members throughout the state of Minnesota. We come before you today in support of House File 3650. We feel it is necessary to pass House File 3650 as a result of confusion, arising from a Supreme Court decision in 2008. Entitled State versus Goster. Because of this decision, our towing members and law enforcement have had significant confusion about when vehicles may be towed. Before this legislation session, we sent letters to several organizations to gauge the support of our bill, clarifying Goster to Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, to the emergency and ambulance drivers, the Insurance Federation, and to representatives of the Sheriff's Association and Chiefs of Police. We have had no negative feedback or any opposition to our bill or changes from the aforementioned groups or in previous committees. This bill does clarify that a unit of government or a peace officer may, and again, still in the discretion of the person in charge at the scene, take into custody or impound an unauthorized vehicle if no other means of safely dealing with a vehicle is immediately available. It would still be a requirement that the driver was arrested or taken into custody. We need this bill not only to clear up confusion out in our highways addressing all safety concerns. Some examples I have for you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee is some instances where some vehicles are being left on the side of the roadways. They're not removed from the roadways, and it's creating some opportunities as far as safety concerns are arisen. And for instance, if there's a vehicle on the side of the road and you or I go to retrieve that vehicle, our towing operators are by law to have safety vests on and flashing lights to bring safety to themselves and to the general public who are traveling near that vehicle or the towing operator. We've also learned in the last couple weeks in the city of Apple Valley, near Eagan-Apple Valley cities, that there was an individual that was pulled over for DUI, was taken to the police station, was handled appropriately by the police, and 2 hours later, a sober individual came and picked them up. They took them back to their vehicle, and I don't know if it's a world record or not, but in a matter of minutes, they were pulled over for a second DUI in the same evening. So I guess hearing some testimonies earlier today, having children, and I think what all of us are heartfelt is that I have a 2- and a 5-year-old, and it'd be kind of ridiculous if you know, I'd lose my kids or my life or wife if somebody was back on the roadways after a DUI. I think that's be pretty irritating to me as a individual and a constituent of this great state.
Questions from members? Representative Paymar.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to, Representative Rosenthal, understand what you're, I understand the testimony here, but so is this granting law enforcement more power relative to impounding cars that we currently grant them, because this is not just DWIs, it's also an individual driving without a valid driver's license.
Actually, the A-10 amendment.
Did that all change that?
Yeah.
Then maybe I'm operating on the wrong one.
Representative Paymar.
Then maybe you can explain the amendment to me once again.
If you look on
Representative Rosenthal.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, if you look on the original bill, line 2.9.
Yep.
Everything after that is stricken by the A-10 amendment. And there was an oral amendment I think the testifier can speak to last night in the Senate hearing that I'm not sure exactly where it is.
I get it now.
Okay.
Got it. Thank you. Sorry.
Is there a need for an oral amendment, Representative Rosenthal?
No, there was one that's now in the A-10 amendment. I don't know where.
Okay.
What part of the original bill it was intended to.
Further questions replace. From members? Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to clarify for me, it says a peace officer may take the vehicle into custody unless another means of safely dealing with the vehicle is not immediately available. So in other words, if there were another capable driver in the vehicle, they would be allowed to take the vehicle off the roadway.
Representative Rosenthal.
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, that's correct.
Further questions? Seeing none. Oh, Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, whoever would like to answer. Okay, so if a police officer stops somebody, the car is in a decent place, is the car still going to be impounded or only in... I guess I have a problem with the testifier from the organization he's from. Mm-hmm. They're going to make money on this. I have a problem with that.
Interesting.
So is it just in certain circumstances, or we're just giving the arresting officer the power to just impound anything?
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mason. I think it speaks to certain circumstances. I don't know the exact answer to your question, so maybe...
Mr. Platt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Mason. They still have to be arrested and taken to custody. So if they are pulled over for not having a valid insurance or valid license, they have to be taken to custody. I guess hopefully that can answer your question, Representative.
Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If someone is charged with careless driving and the charges are either dropped or that person is acquitted, who pays?
Mr. Platt?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, can you repeat, or Representative, can you please repeat that question?
Representative Jackson.
Sure. If a driver is arrested and taken into custody and charged with careless driving under the change in the statute that's being proposed, and the charges are either dropped or that person is acquitted, their car has now been impounded, there is a charge for that. Who pays for that?
Mr. Platt.
Madam Chair, Representative, if you don't mind, I'd like to bring one of my witnesses to sure. bring up and answer that question. Towing operators.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Dwayne Gregory with Allen Service, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Answer to your question is I don't know of anybody that's ever been arrested for careless driving. You issued a citation. I don't see any reason why they would tow a car for careless driving. Is that what your question was,
Madam Chair?
Okay, just a second. Representative Jackson.
Well, it's included, and so if that were not a possibility, my guess is it would not be included in the language of this proposed statute if it were an impossibility.
It's from Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Kulik Jackson, the 810
amendment. Got rid of that.
Yes.
All right. Never? Representative Drzegowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Platt or Mr. Hager?
Dwayne Gregor.
Gregor. The end on 2.1 or 2.3, it says is not immediately available. How is that going to play out in the field? I mean, if the individual is arrested and taken into custody, if they say, "Hey, you know what? I got a friend who can come and pick up the vehicle. I need to get a hold of them on the phone first." What is the response of law enforcement or their connection with you and your business going to be at that point? Is there going to be an adequate opportunity for that individual to call that person and come and get the vehicle or not?
I think Representative Cornish looks like he wanted to answer that question. Representative Cornish, you might just want to ask.
Well,
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, to begin with, when I first looked at this language, I didn't see a big problem, but when you look at it now at the amendment, there's numbers of different reasons why you would want to tow a vehicle, and I'm actually worried that this is getting too restrictive from the peace officer. The immediately available, what's that going to mean when the officer is in a car and gives the person in custody a chance to call somebody? It's kind of like the implied consent. You can let it drag on for hours or while, you know, you've got a car in a tow-away zone or a curve or it's the wheels are off it. This thing, it's looking pretty restrictive. I wish the language was better. This restricts an officer a lot more, I think, than what it's trying to do. So there's some cloudy language here I wish was better. But there's a number of reasons why you'd want to tow a vehicle. If it's not drivable, you're worried about the... it's been pointed out to me that it says may take into custody and impound any vehicle. But anyway, back to your original question. Yeah, there's numbers of reasons why you would want to tow a vehicle. A tow-away zone, or if it's got a lot of expensive equipment in there, you'd want the liability for leaving it there. You want to tow it to a safe and impound it, or if it's a forfeiture thing, or if it's I guess I'd like a cop to come to the table and let me hear what they actually think about it.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, also on behalf of the Police Chiefs Association here on this particular question. If I could take the previous question first, ma'am, Representative
Jackson's
question. Could you raised the issue with regards to the careless driving, and then the charges were dismissed. What would happen to the towing fee?
Representative Jackson.
Thank you. And perhaps a better question, since that was cleared up, is if there's an acquittal of whatever it is you've been charged with, who pays? And I imagine that the vehicle owner does.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair and representatives, this often becomes a part of the plea bargain negotiation for the dismissal. In cases I've been involved in, we, the law enforcement agency, have reimbursed or paid the toll for them when the charges have been dismissed. It's a course of civil action against the law enforcement agency as to why you towed the car And it basically boils down to a case of conciliation court. Most of the time, the towing charges are anywhere from $50 to $100, whatever it is, and depending on the circumstances. But in my commands in the past, we have done it both ways. We have paid for it. We have negotiated it. It is usually resolved in some amicable way after a charge such as you've described has been dismissed or found not guilty. So that is how that has normally happened or occurred. If I may go on with regards to the language here, speaks to the may. It does not make it mandatory. And there's another important word in here in which it speaks to taking the person arresting or taking into custody other means of safely. It requires the law enforcement officer who may do these things to articulate in some degree why it is that I'm towing the vehicle for some safety-related reason. As an example, if you are on the freeway in the middle of an ice storm with cars that are piling up all around you, it's not reasonable to wait an hour for someone to come. If you are on a gravel road, a country road, time may be a different element, again, given your circumstances of where you are. So what this law basically does is require the officer who may take and impound the vehicle and to articulate some degree as to reasonableness as to why they do or don't, and it gives you latitude to leave a vehicle or to take the vehicle. And again, it's somewhat related to the safety and the immediacy of having to do what you're doing with the vehicle. So for that purpose, we think it's workable with common sense prevailing, we hope.
Further questions from members? Representative Kath.
Well, I guess I'm trying to understand then, Madam Chair and the testifier, of why that would be necessary, because it already says on line 1.11 on the amendment, located so as to constitute an accident or a traffic hazard to the traveling public as determined by a peace officer immediately. So I'm trying to figure out what an instance would be where we would need this, because so much of what we're hearing right now is that it's covered under all the instances of how it can be impounded.
Mr. Franklin?
I think as the testimony was in the Senate committee, there was some discussion about the arbitrariness of an officer that might have somebody sitting in the second seat and saying, I'm arresting you, but not allowing you to take the vehicle and drive it away when you are right there. And I think there was some, as I understood the testimony, some concern about that. Hence, this language was put in there that would require the officer to have a test of reasonableness, if you will, to allow that, and not an arbitrary decision on part of an officer that might simply arbitrarily tow that vehicle.
All right. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
That's clear as mud.
Madam Chair.
Representative Coles.
Madam Chair, Representative Kath, if you look at line 1.5, Representative Kath, that's referring to line 1.7, a vehicle may also be impounded after it's been left unattended. This is dealing with vehicles that are attended. There's somebody there with them. So I think the new language is not only appropriate but necessary, and I think is going to be useful to law enforcement. Thanks for bringing the bill forward, Representative Rosenthal.
Further questions? Representative Mullen.
Thank you, Chairwoman. This is a quick comment, but only the real point to remember is this is an amendment to a presently existing statute. This is not a new bill. The presently existing statute is in a worse shape than what this amendment does.
Seeing no further questions, Representative Rosenthal renews his motion that House File 3650 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Transportation and Transit Policy and Oversight Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. This meeting is adjourned.